Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mickey, and I'm a real alcoholic. And I've been sober by the grace of God, and because Alcoholics Anonymous works, since February 5th of 1987, and for that I'm truly grateful. I'm from Bryan, Texas, where the men are men. The sheep run scared. And the women are cunning, baffling, and powerful. And it is my extreme pleasure to be here with you this weekend. I've kind of been wondering all weekend what a straight girl like me is doing in a place like this. But God has always been good to me and given me always wonderful abilities to have fun. And I love to have fun. I just love everything. This has been a great weekend. I've had a lot of fun. The play last night was awesome, wasn't it? Yeah. It was so funny, and I just love being around people. People are just addicting to me, and I love being around good people and people who like to have fun and people who know who they are. And you know, it's just been great. And I want to thank the committee for allowing me to be here this weekend and stay in this beautiful hotel, and my hotel room is just beautiful. And I love staying in hotels. I've never lost that. I stay in a lot nicer hotels, though, than I have in the past, and it's great. And I want to thank my friend Connie for driving down here with me and meeting her friend from San Antonio, Denise. And Connie's really cool. I like hanging out with Connie, and Connie really knows who she is. She's kind of, to sum it up, was a story about Connie. Connie came into an AA meeting the other day, and there was this guy sitting there, newcomer, drinking coffee, and he had this cowboy hat on and one of those big license plate cowboy buckles, and had his ropers on and his spurs on. And Connie sidled over there to him and got a cup of coffee and said, "Hey, newcomer, are you a cowboy?" He said, "Well, I've been roping cattle all my life and branding cattle and working the fields and breaking the mares." He said, "Yeah, I think I am a cowboy." And Connie, being as Connie is, says, "Well, I'm a lesbian." "I'm not only out of the closet, I'm in the living room with my feet on the coffee table. I think about women from the time I get up to the time I go to bed. I think about women when I'm eating lunch. I think about women when I'm eating dinner. I think about women when I'm taking my shower. I think about women all day long." This newcomer is just kind of looking at her, you know. I came into that meeting a few minutes later, and I walked up to him and kind of looked at him all over, and I said, "Hey, newcomer, are you a cowboy?" He said, "I thought I was, but after talking to Connie, I found out I'm a lesbian." Gotta love it. Gotta love AA. Serious program, though, right? I didn't start drinking until I was 12. That's kind of late nowadays, but, you know, there was something wrong with me long before I ever took that first drink. You know, I started stealing as soon as I could walk. I started lying as soon as I could talk. And I don't know what all that was about, except I was born into a family of alcoholism, and there was a lot of chaos in that family. My mother never took a drink in her life, but my mother's definitely suffered from the disease of alcoholism. I'm one of those people who does believe that alcoholism is a family illness, and she was gravely affected. She was married to my father, who was a very abusive alcoholic. He would drink, and I knew what the problem was. He would drink, and he acted in bizarre fashions. We never knew what was going to happen from one minute to the next. And the whole family's kind of centered around on him and what he was doing. And my mom finally got to the point where she could not take it any longer and asked him to either quit drinking or leave. And he left. And I was about 10 or 11 years old, and I can remember him leaving. I thought for a long time, until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and found this way of life and began to understand alcoholism, I thought my father left because he didn't love me. And what I believe today is I believe my father left because he did love me. I believe that when you know and you're in the throes of this illness, you know what a worthless human being you are. And I think the most kind and loving thing he could do was to leave our family. But I didn't know how to deal with that, and I know my mom went to work and sometimes was working 3 and 4 jobs a day to support my sister and I, to put food on the table and clothes on the back, on our backs. And she wasn't around a whole lot. So I was raised very undisciplined. I had no structure. I kind of just went and did what I wanted to do. And being born this kind of restless, irritable, and discontent person into this family of insanity, I was also very selfish and self-centered. And I can tell you with great regret that while I was out running around doing what I wanted to do, my mom never came home after working all those jobs. She never came home to a clean house or a cooked meal because I was always running around doing what I wanted to do. Thank God for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I know that when I got to the 11th step, the light really, really came on for me as I began to really grow in this program. And with my parents, I was able to look at that 11th step prayer where it says, Lord, help me to understand rather than be understood. And as I began to understand my father's illness of alcoholism and began to understand the effects it had on my mother, and today I make amends to my mom by being an absolute wonderful daughter, the best daughter that I can be to her, because that's what she deserves. And she's an awesome lady. I'm so grateful I didn't get what I deserved, that she's still in my life today after all the hell I have put her through. But I was living in a small town not far from Bryan, Hearn, Texas. Some of y'all might know where Hearn is. I'm sorry. But back then, there wasn't a whole lot to do in Hearn, and my friends and I were walking down the street there in Hearn, Texas, and neighbor had his garage door open. We were 12 years old, and in his garage were these cases of long neck Miller beer. Just sitting there out in the heat of the summer, had dust and cobwebs all over him, so I know this guy couldn't have been an alcoholic. I don't know why he had this big stash, but he did. And so my friends and I went in there and stole this man's liquor and went down to my friend's house and proceeded to open this hot long neck Miller beer and drink it. And being 65 or 70 pounds, however much we weighed, not very much, it didn't take long for us to reach that feeling of intoxication, almost instantly followed by nausea and vomiting. We didn't know anything about drinking beer. We didn't know anything about any of that. But I know we got sick as dogs. And we didn't have those skills that would come with more learning and commitment to this new way of life. We didn't know about putting your finger down your throat and puking so you could go back and drink some more. We didn't know about putting one foot on the floor to keep the room from spinning. We didn't. All that would come with further commitment and skill. We somehow got into my friend's house and proceeded to get into the bed. And, I mean, we were so deathly ill, and we woke up the next morning just green, you know, just hungover, sick, didn't know what was going on. And my friend looked at me that morning and said, my God, Mickey, I'm never doing that again. And she never did. The rest of our years in junior high and high school together, I never remember seeing that girl tie one on. She just didn't do it. And I looked at her that same morning with that same green skin and the same sickness, and I said the very same thing. I said, you're absolutely right. I'm never going to do that again either. And I never did. I never drank hot Miller beer again. Because alcohol did something for me that morning that it didn't do for my friend. It had a profound effect on me that for many, many years, until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know that I was different from the other population of this world who can drink and not enjoy drinking the same way that I did. But being from that family that I had come from, I suppose, and just being the way I was, restless, irritable, and discontent, alcohol did something for me and to me that nothing else had ever done. And in that brief period of intoxication, I was okay. I was just okay. And for the next 20 years of my life, I sold my soul to try to re-experience that feeling. You know, it just kind of took away the pain of the past, and it took away the fear of tomorrow, and it just made me okay right now, and that's all I have ever wanted, was to just be okay right now. And thank God Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that, the ability to be okay right now. Not worrying about yesterday or tomorrow, but just right now, I'm okay. When I tell you I'm an alcoholic, my problem's not alcohol. If it was, quitting drinking would be my solution. When I tell you I'm an alcoholic, my problem is living life sober. I don't like sober. Sober was boring and dull and depressing, and I'm a happening person, stuck in this little small town, you know? But I was a happening person. I had to be going all the time. I had this energy. I had this vitality. I had to be doing crazy and bizarre things. You know, I wasn't any good at getting positive attention, but I was real good at getting negative attention. And negative attention is better than no attention. And I had to be out there. You had to know when I walked into a room, I was there. I made sure of that. And it was that selfishness and that self-centeredness that went along with this illness that we have. And anyway, I started trying to experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I became a regular at stealing this stuff and getting people to buy it for me at a very, very young age. I had my first blackout when I was 14 and didn't understand that and learned real quick how to rationalize and justify those things, you know, as to what was going on. And by the time I graduated high school, I was drinking football players under the table. And I thought they were the ones with the problem. I mean, I could drink more than them and drive them home. And I thought they were the ones. They were weak. They were wimps. They couldn't handle it. I was handling it. And for a lot of years, I did. I didn't know I was developing this thing called tolerance. I didn't know I was developing alcoholism. I had no idea what alcoholism was. I knew my dad was an alcoholic when he, you know, because he drank and did bizarre things, and I wasn't going to be like him. A sitting duck. Just a sitting duck. At about the age of 14, too, when I started blacking out, I started experiencing with better living through chemistry, and found a new path there. I started smoking those funny cigarettes and started eating these kind of pills, taking trips and never leaving the room. Feel like I was layered in three sheets of foam. And it wasn't uncommon to find me crawling around in a cow pasture after a heavy rain. You know? When I tell you I'm an alcoholic, for me, I'm addicted to the feeling of intoxication. And for me, this type of real alcoholic, I found that in a lot of forms, you know. And so I started doing bizarre and crazy things, and I started associating with those people that did those bizarre and crazy things. Fast people, fast crowds, doing things that move, movers and shakers, you know. I started running around with older people and people that rode big motorcycles and, you know, none of those rice burners, those real motorcycles, the American-made Harley-Davidson. And I started doing all kind of bizarre and crazy things, hanging around tattoo parlors because people didn't do that, you know. Especially young women didn't get tattoos, and so I started getting my body tattooed. Today I just say that my body's a work of art. And I started getting tattoos all over me just to be defiant. You know, I was just a rebel. I was rebel with a cause. I was rebel without a cause. I was just a rebel because, you know. Just the thing to do. But I never got any tattoos put on my breast, and there's a reason for that. There are some things I remembered along the way, and one of those things is I was a young girl hanging around the tattoo parlor. I heard the story about this young woman who had a rosebud tattooed on her breast, and then when she became 75, it was a long stem rose. And so I never did that. That stuck with me, and it's still there. Anyway, I just started doing those wild things, and I started, I had this sister who had become the cheerleader kind of person, and while she was out cheering the team on, I was in the parking lot stealing hubcaps, you know. I just was doing bizarre and crazy things, and ended up looking for love in all the wrong places, wanting so desperately, and not even knowing. But I think that we all have this spiritual condition as human beings to feel needed and to feel wanted. And I wanted so desperately to feel important in someone's life and to feel needed and special. And I didn't know how to get any of that because I didn't know how to give that. And I didn't know how to do that. And what I ended up doing is what I see so many people still doing, and I did for a long time, was I traded all that for sex. That was the only way I could get a semblance of what that need was. I know today that's a spiritual condition, and I didn't know that then. And so I ended up trading that, trying to get that through sex. And at the age of 16 in small town Texas, I found myself pregnant, not knowing what to do. I tried to just deny that, you know. I just turned my head away. This can't be happening to me. How could this happen to me, you know? Again, that self-centeredness. And so I tried to drink that away. Just drink it away and forget about it, you know. But you can only deny being pregnant for so long, and it becomes quite evident. And I ended up going to Austin, Texas, and had this illegitimate child. And, you know, I cursed God for allowing this to happen to me. I don't know where I came up with the ideas that I had, but I believe God was responsible for everything in a person's life. I didn't know anything about self-will, especially self-will run riot. And I didn't know anything about being responsible for your own actions. I thought everything was kind of predestined and pre-planned, and that God had a hand in everything that happened to you. And I cursed God for letting me be pregnant. And then at the same time, I thanked God because He put a family in my life that said, we want this child and we will raise it as our own. And I did what I let these people have that child, and I believe that that was the best thing for me to do at that time for that child. And I still believe that today. And anyway, I came back to small town Texas after having this illegitimate child, and I tell you, I felt like I had this big cross on my forehead, you know, the scarlet letter. Today it's not too uncommon for 16-year-old women to be having 16-year-old children to be having children, but in 1972 in small town Texas, it was not the cool thing to do. And being alcoholic on top of that, and selfish and self-centered, didn't help matters at all. And I literally, at 16 years of age, I had to have alcohol or some chemical in my body to walk out on that street to go to school whenever I went. But I had to have something that would allow me to walk out on that street and hold my head up and say, I don't care what you think. Because I'm an alcoholic, I have that built-in sixth sense, you know? People would turn and look at me, and I knew what they were thinking. Nobody had to say a word to me. I knew what they were thinking. And I tell you, that's one thing I have to still watch today, is that to not start believing I know what other people are thinking about me. And what I know today, because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that has given me the ability to go back through my life and see what was going on with me, I know today that I shamed myself to the pit of hell for what I thought you were thinking. And I don't have to do that anymore today. What a freedom. What a promise. I don't have to do that anymore today. But I somehow graduated high school. That's a whole other story. I was a good cheater. I was a quick learner. And I somehow got out of high school and made my first geographical change. I was going to go somewhere where no one knew me. Had the best intentions in the world. I'm going to go somewhere and I'm going to start over. I'm going to become somebody. I'm going to get a career. I'm going to have a job. I'm going to find me a good man to marry, and I'm going to have children to replace that child I had lost, which, by the way, didn't work. But that was my plan, and that was my goal, and I was going to do these things, and I was going to have these children. I was going to be a wonderful mother, and I was going to have a good husband. And I was going to join the PTA, you know. I mean, I had these ideas down pat what I wanted to do. But I didn't have a plan of action. I didn't have a program. I didn't know how to get those things. I didn't know how to reach those goals. So I moved 500 miles away from Hearne, Texas, to a small town right outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, where they do it 24/7. You know, not a good move for someone in my mental and physical condition, spiritual condition. And I was down in Louisiana 2 weeks, a total of 2 weeks, before I ended up in jail. And I'm wondering, how did this happen? You know, I had been doing that in Texas. I started going to jail when I was 14, and I kind of would always blame others and never take responsibility. And here I moved 500 miles away with these plans and these dreams and these goals. Why is this happening to me there? I felt like I was snake bit, or God was punishing me, or, you know, I didn't really know what was going on. I just couldn't believe that this was happening to me here again. And I somehow ended up getting out of jail. I love it when Johnny Harris talks about it doesn't take a genius to get out of jail. It just takes time. And when my time was up, I got out of jail and had to make some quick decisions about how I was going to get out of this trouble. You know, I mean, that's plan. How are you going to get out of this now? So what I ended up doing is I made a decision to marry the guy I got busted with. That way, he couldn't testify against me, and I couldn't testify against him. You gotta have a reason to get married. And it made perfect sense to me, so we got married and took in sick, and somehow ended up it cost me a little bit of money. I got out of that situation. But my lifestyle didn't change. I didn't know how to change it. I didn't know how to quit doing what it was that I was already doing and had been doing for so many years. Instantly started having children. I had a son who is now 24 years old. His name is Micah. He's a medic in the Army now. He's married to a young girl, and they are expecting their third child. They haven't wasted any time either. And shortly after that, I have a daughter was born to me. Her name is Monica. She's 21. Fixing to be 22, lives about a mile from my house, and I absolutely have the best relationship in the world with this daughter of mine. And thank God I don't get what I deserve. Thank God. And I really desperately wanted to be a mother. I wanted to be a wife, but I didn't know how to do that. I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't know that either. And being an alcoholic and a good wife and a good mother just don't go, they don't mix. And I love my children. I love my children more than my own life. There's never been a time that if there was ever a point made, it's your wife or your children, hey, I would not even have to think about that decision. I love my children more than my life. I love them more than anything in this world. But I'm an alcoholic. I don't believe there's anything stronger than a mother's love for her child, except alcoholism. And my alcoholism took me from those children many, many times. Ended up destroying that marriage with that man I was married to. And I ended up moving back to Texas in 1980. I like to say moved back to Texas because it sounds better than unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And it was one of those spiritual moves, you know, where you have the U-Haul trailer up there at midnight and you're falling in there. You're heading for the border and you finally get there and you think, oh my God, thank God, I'm never going to look back and never go back there again. Not knowing there's a step number 9. So you come back again, I'm going to start over. And I moved back to Bryan, Texas in 1980. And by then, I had made a lot of other really, really poor decisions. There in Louisiana, under the influence of alcohol one night, I let a friend put a needle in my arm. And when I came back to Texas, I was drinking around the clock. I was putting needles in my arms. I was doing things that women don't do. I was becoming a really detriment to society and not a very good person. And I was dragging these small babies around with me, and it was bad. You know, I was always able to rationalize and justify every single thing I did. I have an old-timer who's gone to that big meeting in the sky now, but he always said, rationalization, justification, masturbation. They're all the same because when you do any one of them, you only screw yourself. And I was screwing myself on a regular basis, you know, with the things that I came up with. You know, with these children, I just want to talk about them for a second. They loved their mother, you know, and they tried to help me, and the roles really got reversed there. I'm one of those kind of women that goes to the store for a loaf of bread and doesn't come back for 3 days, you know. And I would go and I would be out doing my deal, and I would come back home and I would be so sick and tore up and down, and I would get in my bed and I would get violently ill and I would puke all over myself and that kind of stuff. And these little beautiful blonde-haired, gold-eyed children would always come to their mama with a wet washcloth and they would clean their mom up. And these babies knew the truth. Little bitty babies. And they knew the truth because they would say, "Mama, if you don't drink, you won't get sick." They knew the truth. And there were so many times when I would look at those babies and I would be filled with so much guilt and remorse and self-hate and condemnation. And I would look at those babies and I would know in my heart that they deserved better. They needed better. And I would look at them and I would make those promises to them. I'd say, "Babies, I'm not going to drink anymore." And I would tell them those promises that I had told them many, many times. "I'm going to stay home with you." Now, my guts were screaming out, "I love you. I want to be your mother." And I would make those promises that would say, "Say, well, we're going to pop some popcorn and we're going to get a movie or we're going to go to the circus." Yeah, that's what I wanted so desperately to do. But I'm an alcoholic. But I would make those promises and those children would get a little bit of hope in their eyes. Once again, they would get a little hope in their eyes that maybe this time she means it. But I'm an alcoholic. And what would end up happening is what happened every time I made those promises. Those children would go off and they'd begin to play. And pretty soon they'd get a little bit too loud. And that knot starts in my stomach and I start to get a little bit shaky. Because you see, I'm not only a mother, I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't know what was going on. And then the obsession that's described so wonderfully in the big book would happen. And the thought to take one drink, to take that edge off. If I just could calm those shakes a little bit and get that knot out of my stomach, then I could stay there and I could be a good mother and I could play with those children. And all those promises, that obsession just destroyed all of those promises. And I would go to that kitchen or to that closet or wherever it was and I would take that drink. And when I took that first drink, the drink would take me. And I'd end up having to go to the store one more time and leave those babies there. And I'll tell you this with great shame and regret, that I left those children with people children didn't need to be left with. My babies have seen things that no child should ever see. They've heard things that no children should ever hear. And they experience things that no human should ever experience. When I was 6 years sober, my daughter had begun to date this young man, and she started having some problems, and thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous that by the time I was 6 years sober, I had learned enough to be a mom and that my children had trusted me. And my daughter came to me, and she needed to talk to me about something, that some problems she was having. And she revealed to me that when I was out getting a loaf of bread, the 15-year-old boy lived in there. In the neighborhood repeatedly raped my baby girl. How do you make amends for that? I'm sorry, just don't cut it. How do you make amends to something so heinous and so horrible that robbed my baby of who she was as a young child? And what do you say that's right makes that right? If you ever experience such an event, such a horrible tragedy in your life, then and only then will you understand the mercy of a loving, caring God. It goes far beyond the grace of God. I'm talking about mercy. And I have been there. I have received the mercy of a loving Creator who's allowed me to take the action that was appropriate to get that baby the help she needed. And thank God I don't get what I deserve. That young girl loves her mom today. I just celebrated a birthday in October, and she sent me flowers like she does every year. And this year the card said, to most terrific mom and my best friend. Thank God I don't get what I deserve. Also in October, I was able to take her with me, and we went to the Virgin Islands. And you want to talk about a spiritual experience as I was laying up on that beach watching that little child of mine out there in that water snorkeling, free in the elements, free. and the freedom I felt is after getting her the professional help she needed. When her father and I sat and held hands and cried as she walked down the aisle to marry that young man she's going out with. And that she walked down that aisle a free and whole woman. Thank God she trusted her mother enough to come to me with that. And thank Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me the ability to be that person she could come to. What a neat girl. She's an awesome child. I just didn't know that I could love as much and as deeply as I do with that child of mine. I love that son of mine terribly, but there's just something different with me and this girl. I don't know what it is, but it's just something unique about it. Anyway, if you're paranoid and you think they're out to get you, they are. I've never been paranoid unnecessarily, you know. And I was doing my deal, rationalizing and justifying the whole entire way, you know. And the law came and knocked on my door in 1986, rather loudly and forcefully, and arrested me for a first-degree felony punishable by up to 99 years in the penitentiary. And I thought, Jesus, they're really getting serious here, you know. This wasn't any really big deal. I mean, God, what they were charging me with, I was just hanging out with my friends, my buddies, my pals, my compadres. In Bryan, Texas, they call that organized crime, and they didn't like that. I'm like, gee whiz, this is serious stuff. So I ended up going to jail and somehow made bond and got out. And I don't know about, y'all have this problem here in Houston, but I'm one of those alcoholics that gets in trouble when you're in trouble. Got any of those here? Yeah. So I got in trouble once again. I ended up going back to jail and staying in, and was held at no bond for a really, really long time. You know, jail was always kind of a spiritual experience for me. I don't jail well. I don't like it, you know. I was always angry and horrified. But, you know, I would go into jail, and I'm, of course I'm being all out and cocky and rough and tough. Until everybody gets out of the way. And when nobody was looking, I always found God. Nobody was looking, I'd kind of get over there by my cot, by myself, and, you know, maybe even get down on my knees, you know? And I had that 911 God. You know, it's like I pulled out that cell phone and said, 911 God, it's me again, you know? Please get me out of this one. I'll never do it again. And you mean that. You wouldn't lie directly to God, you know, knowing that it's a lie. You can't really BS God, you know. And I would make that prayer, and I was so sincere in it. I was so sincere. I truly, honestly meant that with everything I have in my whole soul and heart and being. I really meant that I was not going to do that again. But I had no idea what was wrong with me. I had no idea about the power of this illness. And they would end up doing my time would come and they'd end up opening those cell doors and they would call my name and I would go back out. But what always ended up happening is I left God locked up in jail. And I went back out on the street and did the exact same thing that put me there in the first place because I didn't know any different. It wasn't until I found you in Alcoholics Anonymous in a program of action that allowed me to take God with me into every area of my life and to every function. And I didn't know how to do that. So I was doomed to repeat that same cycle. Now here I am faced with this first degree felony. 99 years, geez, you know. I didn't know what I was going to do, so that keen thinking kicks in. You know, how are you going to get out of this one? And somewhere in jail I heard somebody mention Alcoholics Anonymous. That if you go to AA, it'll look good when you go to court. Now, I know y'all don't have that problem here in Houston at all, but I went to my first AA meeting because I knew it would look good when I went to court. I was willing to do anything, you know. So I went to my first AA meeting, and I walked in, and when I walked in the door, those people looked at me, and they said, oh, you're a newcomer. You're the most important person here. And I said, hell, I know that, you know. So they got all excited, you know, they're getting all excited and they start this little first step meeting about what it was like and what happened and what it was like, what it's like now. And they started telling me their wimpy little stories, you know. One guy started talking about how he drank, and his drinking got so bad that his wife left him. And the pain of that was so great that he went to AA. And he put the plug in the jug, and his life was wonderful, and his wife came back. And I'm thinking to myself, Jesus Christ, what a wimp, you know? One wife, one time, God, you know? There's other fish in the sea. Find a woman that'll drink with you, buddy. And then some girl in the back jumps up, and she's so excited because she has got this little minimum wage part-time job, and she had saved up enough money to buy this used vehicle, and she didn't know which one to get, the blue one or the red one. And I'm thinking, I'd pay for a car? Who would do that, you know? Get both of them and get a better one than that, you know? I couldn't understand what she was saying. I couldn't understand that she was talking about honest living and getting a day's pay for a day's work. I mean, that was foreign concepts to me. I mean, if you wanted something, go steal it, or, you know, you knew somebody that could get it for you. I just didn't understand what these people were talking about, and I summed up almost instantly that I was too bad for AA. And that this wouldn't work for someone like me. And I went back and did the exact same thing that put me there. Now, I ended up, I had a court date, and they had offered me 20 years at my plea bargain, and I thought, God, no, you know. So I ended up taking it to a trial by jury, and I went to this jury trial in December of 86, and they said it was a jury of my peers, but there wasn't anybody there I'd have hung out with. And I took the stand, man. I raised my hand. I swore to tell the truth, and I lied like a big dog. You know, I mean, I should have gotten an Oscar for my performance there that day. You know, that thing with President Clinton, I understand that completely. When your back's against the wall, baby, you're going to lie like a dog. Ah. By this time, I mean, I've just losing. It was a losing game for me. And anyway, I went through this trial by jury, and somehow this jury was convinced that I might be worth salvaging, and they gave me this sentence that, you know, in their opinion was a good sentence, but for me it was one of the most horrible things you could do to somebody like me. They came back with this sentence of intense supervision probation for 10 years. And I'm like, what? You know, I would have rather had gone on to the penitentiary, done my little turnaround, got back out, and started doing what I wanted to do, like I was doing such a good job anyway. But I was going to do what I wanted to do, and now this thing called intense supervision probation, these people are going to be breathing down my neck, they're going to be watching my every move, they're going to be telling me what to do, and nobody tells me what to do. And I mean, it was horrible. I was so furious that day. And the only thing I knew to do is to make it go away one more time was to go back and continue to drink and do the other things that I was doing just to make it go away, and I'll worry about it tomorrow. You know, not even being able to see. I was so sick, I was not even able to see that these people were willing to give me another opportunity. But you see, I was raised with this thing called a slogan I remember hearing somewhere along the line. And it was such a profound impact on my life, and it kind of goes like this. You made your bed, now lie in it. And you see, when I stuck that needle in my arm a long time ago, and I was doing some of those bad things that I was doing, I had made my bed, and I was willing to lie in it. People like me don't change. I knew what happens to people like me. We end up in prison forever. We end up dead on the side of the road. We end up getting shot down or killed somehow. People like me don't change. We don't make it. And I accepted where I was, and I accepted who I was. And I didn't know that there was any hope for someone like me. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to change the sheets. Change the sheets. But I didn't know that then. And I was furious that these people were going to be telling me how to run my life. And the things just, you know, they talk about that hitting bottom. Well, sometimes you can you hit that bottom, and I just went side to side. You know, there was no coming back up for me. I mean, I just hit bottom and was going side to side because people like me don't change. And I just kept doing the exact same things I knew how to do. It was all I knew how to do. When I got busted, they took everything that I had, including my children. I lost my children. I lost my house. I lost those cars. I lost all those things that it took to make me look important and special and to have some semblance of respect from the other people that were like me. I had all those things. I used to always play those games, my gun's bigger than your gun, you know. Always needed a new diamond or a new something, a new car, something to try to fill my insides up, you know, or a new boyfriend. That was always good, you know. After my divorce, I started running through men like crazy. I was like those young men. I thought if you got them young, you could train them, you know. And I would go out in some of the places the big book calls lower companions, and I would go out to some of these dives and find some young man who was down and out on his luck and could benefit from my experience, wisdom, and knowledge, you know, my experience, strength, and hope. And I would reel him in and take him hostage and begin that training process. Dedicate a lot of time and energy and effort to training these guys to please me in every way. To train them to intuitively know how to handle me in every situation I wanted them to handle me. And they had to please me and they had to be correct every time. But, you know, you got to look at what you're dealing with here. And they would always get ideas of their own and they would try something without me telling them to. And even if it was good, well, I didn't tell them to do it, so then they had to go. But you can't get rid of them until you had another one. You know, you had to have one coming in and one going out. You had to do that kind of simultaneously. Sometimes you ended up all together at one time, and that was good for a weekend drunk, you know. But you had one going out and one coming in, because you never could be without somebody else. Who else are you going to blame for when things go wrong, you know? And I began... The bottom line was I never could accept anyone as they were. I had to change you all the time. Had to change you, and the rules were different every single day. You know, but I never could accept you for as you were. You had to always become better or greater or do this right. And you always had to please me. And what I found, the best way for me to get over one guy was to get in a relationship with another guy. And then when that was over, get into a relationship with another guy. And there was never any time to heal or grow from any of these experiences. And this 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the sexual part of that inventory, allowed me to look back at that and that pattern that I had. And what I've realized that I used to do is whatever this first guy did, the next one paid for. And whatever that guy did, the next one paid for those two. And whatever those three did, the next one caught hell for what all the rest of those did, because I didn't know how to let go of that. I didn't know how to heal from that. You know, if this guy ran around in me, I was insanely jealous of the next one for no reason. And what I know today is I abused a lot of men. I mean emotionally, mentally, physically, verbally. I mean, I just abused a lot of men. And today, the best of my ability, I try to leave you guys alone. God have mercy on you. I'm telling you, it got really, really bad. And I didn't know anything about relationships or men until I came into AA, but it talks so specifically about men in the first 164 pages. It says they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. What an order. I love men today. And I tell you, the most beautiful men in AA are gay, you know? It's pretty depressing. I thought I would come here this weekend and try to change some of you in every area of your life. But I don't do well with repeated rejection. I may end up going back to Brian with suicide on my mind. I don't know. I just love y'all. I really do. And I thank y'all so much for being here. Anyway, I was thing I had, you know, the kids were gone, the important things were gone. I was living in this abandoned house, no electricity, no running water, and I was still fighting. They're not going to tell me what to do. They're not going to tell me how to live. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And I didn't know anything about surrender and fighting the whole thing. And I had this one young man who was left in my life. His name was Bud, and he was 24 years old. And, you know, I was living just like an animal out on the street, being nocturnal, only coming out after dark, and doing horrible things, really, to my community and to anybody that was good and decent. I took your stuff and did what I wanted to do with it. And anyway, this young man came to me one day, and he had tolerated me and put up with me through that whole trial, and he had watched me lose everything, and he was still there. I mean, great candidate for Al-Anon, and he put up with the worst of my abuse. I really was so horrible to this man. This young man, and Bud was 24 years old, and he came to me one day, and he began to present me with some truth. And when you're as sick as I am and in such a horrible place as I was, the truth is the last thing you want to hear. And as he began to present me with this truth, he began to remind me of my failures. He began to point out that my children were gone, that all these horrible things were happening to me, that I was placed on this probation, that I was fixing to go to the penitentiary because I was still doing the exact same thing that started this whole business. And any time anyone reminds me of my failures, I attack you viciously. And I attacked this young man. And I cursed him to a point, I mean, my mouth was spitting venom. And do you know what your tongue can do to other people? And you can't take it back. You can't take it back. And I spewed venom all over this young man to the point to where I know today he couldn't take that anymore. And he finally dropped his shoulders and he looked at me and he said, "I can't live like this anymore. I'm leaving." And I cursed him, making that grandstand play that I had made so many times before. "Go ahead and leave. I don't need you. I don't need anybody. I don't need anything. If everyone would just leave me alone, I'll be all right." What a lie. And we believe those lies. That young man left, and I went back into that abandoned house and did the only thing I knew how to do to make it go away. I'll worry about it tomorrow. Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. Well, tomorrow came, and the sun came up, and I went outside to check on something. And when I went outside that day, my life changed from that day to this. I found that young man's solution to our problems. That young man's body hung from a tree limb with a rope around his neck, and he was dead. And he had been dead for about 5 hours while I was in there making it all go away. That young man took the hard way, tough way out. My life changed from that point to this because something changed in me. A terror gripped me that I cannot even begin to explain to you. It seemed to me that at that point, there was a realization that went through me into my very soul of all of the pain and hurt and turmoil that I had caused everyone in my life, that I was responsible for everything that was going on, that I was in the position I was in because of me. And I'm telling you, to come to such a realization at that at one time can only do one thing, and what it did to me was drive me to a depth of insanity I thought I could never return. And people tried to comfort me by telling me the most ridiculous things, like they told me that this young man's death was because he was a coward, that he just couldn't face life on life's terms. Well, I'm going to tell you one thing. I am brave and I am tough. Where I come from, physical pain was what earned you respect on the street. You know, I had done things and been involved in things where it took a great amount of courage,
even though it was stupid. It took a great amount of courage. But I couldn't get in a tree and put a noose around my neck and jump. If I could, if I had that courage, you'd have a different speaker here today. I don't think it was about being a coward. My God, can you imagine? Nor do I think it's about being brave. What I think his suicide is like, and so many thousands of suicides are like, is being in so much pain that death seems like your only option, your only solution. Then, and only then, will you do something of that magnitude. I know I've wanted to do it. I know I wished to do it. I know I wanted to be dead, but I couldn't do it. I started running. And I was driving in this truck I had. I'll tell you about that truck in a minute. But I was driving around this truck that I had, and the surrender finally began for me. After being in this insanity for weeks of just crazy, just hearing things and seeing things that you knew weren't there, and but you couldn't stop it. And it was like that song, Life in the Fast Lane, will surely make you lose your mind. It was everything all the time, and I just couldn't get my head to shut up. And I was running. And the surrender happened for me as a tear began. I'm one of those tough broads, baby. I don't cry for nothing. And this tear began to come, and it began, and once it started, it just opened up the floodgate for all the tears. And I finally began, I just started bawling. And I had to pull off the side of the road. I mean, I just couldn't drive. I couldn't see. I couldn't do anything. My body was shaking violently. And I pulled off the side of the road, and I just broke down and bawled. And I hadn't done that in 20 years. And I just started crying. And after a few minutes, I don't know, it seemed like forever, I sat up and I looked around, and I had that deja vu experience, you know? And what I know today is that only in the point of surrender can God intervene. When you're fighting, God don't stand a chance. And when I had begun to surrender in the form of breaking down and just screaming, crying, God was able to intervene. Because I had that deja vu experience, and I looked around, and it took me a little while to realize I was outside that AA meeting I had been to many months before. And the true miracle was, is it was 7:45 and people were walking in. I knew some force within me, I know today is God, I knew I had to get in that building. I had to go in there. And I started up the path and I fell, and it was raining and it was cold and it was muddy. I hadn't eaten in days. I hadn't slept in weeks. And I literally crawled to what I call my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would love to tell you that the Brian group of Alcoholics Anonymous rushed to my side with a plate of donuts and a cup of coffee, saying, "Let us help you up, you poor, precious child of God." But that's not what they did. What they did is they came and they stood over me and they looked down at me. And they said, "Mickey, are you sick and tired of being sick and tired, and have you had enough?" My God, I had had enough. I had beat myself into submission. I could not fight anymore. There was no more energy left. And they kind of scooped me up and got me into a chair, and I don't remember anything about any meetings for a long, long time. I had nowhere else to go. I was there. I could somehow feel that these people really meant to help me. I don't know. And I just remember they say, "Keep coming back." And someone instructed me where the next meeting was. And I just started doing that. Now, I would love to tell you that I came to AA looking and acting as I do today, which was not the case. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was driving this truck. And I told you when I got busted, they took everything I had. And they did. They took everything I had except this truck. And the reason they didn't take this truck is they didn't want this truck. I got this truck in a drug deal, gave a guy half a gram of dope, he gave me this truck. I figured it out one day, that truck cost me $12.50, and I got ripped off. This truck. truck had been sank in a tank of water long enough to where the entire bottom had completely rusted out. I had to steal carpet to put in the floorboard to keep the trash from blowing up on the road at me. It had wires come out of places wires aren't supposed to be. It was one of those big, butch, early Dodge Ram vans, you know? 70 model Dodge van that used to have power steering. The headlights worked some of the time, and most of the time they didn't. You'd get it cranked up after about 15 minutes, drop it in reverse, and it'd die. My God has a great sense of humor. It took me exactly time to get from one meeting to the next for that truck to get started and go. And when I came into AA, I don't look anything like I looked then. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, ladies, don't get excited, but when I came in AA, I wore these skin-tight blue jeans or these black leather pants tucked in these knee-high boots with this brass tip on the end because I was cool. I wore this black T-shirt with the sleeves and the neck cut out because I was tough. I wore this big leather jacket with this fringe that hung down on it because I was sexy. I wore this big black wallet in my back pocket with this dog chain that hung down to my knees and hooked up here on this belt loop because I was hot. I wore this big wad of keys over here on my belt loop that made a lot of noise when I walked. I mean, you heard me long before you ever saw me because of this big wad of keys that hung over here on my hip. Every time I took a step, boy, they just jangled. It was like music to my ears. Now, I'm living in an abandoned house. My truck starts with a screwdriver. And I got this big wad of keys hanging over here on my hip. I wore this black outlaw hat pulled down here over my eyes, and I had to wear my sunglasses in those AA meetings because the light was just a little bit too bright. I heard someone say that we were sensitive. And I had this filthy mouth going with it that came in. Sometimes I wore those little gloves that had the fingers cut out in there because I was just too cool. Johnny Harris says this too, if I'd have got any cooler, I'd have froze to death. And I came walking into AA like that, slinging those chains, rattling those keys with this attitude that got way before I showed up. One of the things that kept me coming back for a long time was on the Tuesday night and Friday night meetings of the Bryan Group, they had an Al-Anon meeting upstairs. And I would go just to terrorize those Al-Anons. I'd start walking up those steps and I'd be slinging that chain and rattling those keys and I'd round that corner and they'd scatter. I'd say, yeah, baby, come on, you want some of this? No, you don't, because you're scared. You're scared because I'm big and bad and you're not, you know? I hated women, all women, but I especially hated those Al-Anon women. They just made me sick, you know? They always looked so cute. They always wore those little matching outfits, you know, where the bottom matches the top. And they always wore those cute little flats or those wonderful little pumps that matched that little purse that they were carrying. And they always had that makeup on just right. And they had their hair fixed so cute and their fingernails polished. You know, they were just sickening. Those Al-Anon women look just like I do now. Oh, God, I just hated them, you know? They were so weak looking and so sickly, you know, I just couldn't hardly stand it, but I have learned so much from those women today, and it is because of those women that I have become the woman that I am today. It is because of the women in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon today I walk with the grace and dignity of a sober woman alcoholic, one that I never dreamed possible. You know, I say this all the time, and I say this at straight meetings. You know, I can go, and men can pat me on the head and make me feel better and offer me some relief. But if you want recovery, the women have to stay with the women, and the men have to stay with the men. That's just how it works, you know. And I would go into those meetings, and they would talk about getting a sponsor, you know. And I couldn't get a sponsor. I could look around the room, and I would see that young guy over there, Cheryl. With 30 days sober, you know, I bet he could keep me from drinking tonight. And they said, no, you have to have a woman. You have to have a woman. And I thought, well, you know, I'm screwed because I hate women. I'm not going to ask a woman for anything, you know. And what I know today is I hated that part of me, and I didn't know what it was to be a woman. Women are awesome. They're powerful, you know. They're great, and I didn't know that. I was so stupid. I just really didn't have a clue. And so I would go, and I would go to meetings, and for the first 3 months, the only thing they let me do was read How It Works, because there were no cuss words in How It Works. I threw one in every now and then, trying to liven that thing up, you know. God, boring. And I'd want to share, and they'd say, no, you can't share. You don't have anything to say. So I started sitting in the back of the room, and I started talking to the people around me when they were reading that dull and boring How It Works, you know. I heard that thing 100 times, and I'm talking to this one over here, telling them about how big and bad and tough I was, and this one over here trying to scare them a little bit, you know. And I'm loud, so I was making a lot of noise. I mean, during that detox period, I was not any quieter than I am now. And finally, Charlie came over to me, and every group's got a Charlie, you know. That old timer, that guy that's got an answer for everything, you know. And I learned this trick. If you're new, I'll tell you what the trick is. If you go to your sponsor or old timer with something and they don't know what the answer is, they tell you, it's in the book. Charlie came over to me this night and he said, Mickey, why don't you fix your coffee and come sit up front with us? And I thought, well, they finally want to hear some of what it's really like out there, you know, what's really going on out there in the street. So I fixed my coffee and I went and sat up front with Charlie, and he leaned over to me and he said, now sit here and shut up and listen. And Charlie probably saved my life, because I wasn't learning nothing when I was sitting back there running my gums, you know, hearing a thing. I didn't know anything about being patient and tolerant. I didn't know anything about discipline. I mean, I had to be taught the hard way with brute force on those kind of stuff. And then after a while, they finally let me start talking a little bit, and I became a chronic complainer in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I know none of y'all have that problem over here in Houston, but I was still living in this abandoned house, you know, and driving this $12.50 truck, and I didn't have anything. And so I started complaining. This woman came up to me after this meeting, and she said, Mickey, I want to tell you you're full of shit. And turned around and walked off. Nobody talks to me like that. She obviously can't remember I'm the most important person here. And I turned around to tell her about it, and my hand raised and my mouth open, and a voice like mine came out and said, will you be my sponsor? I had screwed up then, you know. Linda Kay had been a whack in the army. She was tough, she was crude, and she was rude. And she didn't care anything about my feelings. She turned around and looked at me from the top of my head to the tip of my toes and back square in the eye. And she said, I don't like you, but I'll help you because I have to stay sober. And she turned her back and I went, let me help you. She said, we're going to do this thing my way, and my way is the way it's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, you're going to go to the same meetings that I go to. She said, you're going to call me every day. I said, I don't have a phone. She said, you're going to call me every day. She said, you're going to go to the same meetings that I go to? She said, but don't sit by me and don't tell anyone I'm your sponsor. It was really kind of good because I started getting better and everybody thought I was just doing it on my own. She said, do you have a big book? I said, no. She said, do you have any money? I said, no. And she said, well, steal one. You can make amends later. So I did. And she said, we're going to go to this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to work the steps as outlined in this book, because this is what's going to save your life. And she said, if you don't do this, you're going to die. And I heard her. And I believed her, because she told me the truth. She said, we're going to get into this book and we're going to immediately do step one. And following step one, we're going to do step two. And immediately we will do step three. And following step three, we're going to do the step four. And so on and so forth until this is through. There were no ifs, ands, buts. There was no, we're going to wait till you feel better to work these, baby. It was, we're going to do this like this or I'm not going to do it at all. And I was like, yes, ma'am, okay, you know, shoot. And I cussed her all the time behind her back, but I never did to her face. And Linda took me by the hand and took me to the gates of hell. She went with me. She wouldn't go for me. And she went with me, and we worked the steps that is outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I can tell you, if you're new in this program, you don't have to wait till you're 5 years sober, or 10 years sober, or 13 years sober, or 20 years sober before you get the freedom of the steps of the program. You will get the result of the step when you complete the step. Whether it's going to take you 10 years if you're fortunate enough to be able to stay, or if it's going to take you 2 days. It's whatever effort you're willing to put into it, you're going to get it back. But one thing, rest assured, if you don't do it, you get nothing. If you don't do it, you'll never get the result of the step. And I went with her, and I will tell you is that by the time I was a year sober, I was a different person, a totally different person. My thinking was different. My feelings were different. My actions were different. I just became different. I became somebody that other people kind of liked to be around. I became a person that somebody else wanted me to be their sponsor. What, God, can you imagine? And my sponsor was one of those people that said, gave me rules outside of AA. She said, no relationships for the first year. I said, none? She said, no. She said, if there's anybody here that would have anything to do with you, they are sick and stay away from them. And I thought, oh, okay. So I made that sacrifice. She said, you have got to develop a relationship with a higher power, because if you don't, you're going to die. And if you don't do these things, you're going to die. And I dared to believe her. I believed her. She taught me about service work, about getting involved and being of service. And now I'm going to tell you the flip side of this whole story. A year ago, 5 days before Christmas, my sponsor was found dead on her floor from an overdose of drugs and alcohol, because my sponsor quit doing service work. My sponsor quit working with others. My sponsor quit working the steps. My sponsor lost the interest and quit going to meetings. You know, that was so true, that little dizzy last night. That little dizzy never goes away. That dizzy will always be there. I 12-stepped my sponsor a few months before she died, and I took her to a meeting at my home group. And I took her, and we went out to dinner, and we had a wonderful time. And I said, Linda, what are you going to do? And she said, you know, I've been thinking about coming back in the program, Mickey. And she said, I want you to be my sponsor. I said, well, here, call me every day. And I didn't get that phone call from Linda. And then she was found dead. You see, Linda thought she had another sobering up to do. But she didn't. She didn't. I know I have another drunk in me, but I do not believe I have another sobering up. And I want to be here with you. This is such an awesome adventure. I got sober. I worked the steps. I was free from this active alcoholism. And I started learning how to be a daughter and to be a mother. And I started learning how to do those things. And when I got to my step 9, I started making amends and started strengthening and developing some relationships for the very first time. Just wanting to be something, don't cut it. You know, you got to take the action. So I took the action and I started doing those things. My children think I'm wonderful. My grandchildren call me Mimi. Because it's me, 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 me. They love me. They want to be around me. My children want to be around me. What a miracle. Thank God I didn't get what I deserve. And then I had to go and I had to make amends to my community. Oh, I was so terrible in my community. And there was a point in my life I thought I was going to have to leave my community. And the old-timers in the program, thank God for the old-timers. They came to me and they sat me down and they said, Mickey, if you leave now, you're going to be running the rest of your life. They said, what you will do is you will stay here and you will look this community in the eye and you will pay back what you have done. And so I did. And I did that in form of service work. Service work in my community. Going to the jails, going into the prisons, going into the federal prison, going into the juvenile detention center, carrying the message, talking to groups of people about Alcoholics Anonymous. Anytime, anywhere, anybody called, said, can you do this? Yes, I will do it. I became willing to go to any lengths to pay back what I had done. And I began to help people rather than hurt people. And what I can tell you is the result of that, 3.5 years with the encouragement of my probation officer, I went back before that judge and he released me from the bondage of the state of Texas because I was a new person. He said that. This is a new person. She has been reborn. And to carry that a little bit further, my probation officer insisted I take more action, more action, more action. I thought, no, no, I made my bed. I can lie in it. This will never happen. She said, change the sheets. I changed the sheets, did some more footwork, and in 1994, I was granted a full pardon by the governor of the state of Texas. And I have all my rights back as a citizen. I've even served on a jury twice. Not only was I a juror, but I was foreman of the jury. I'm telling you, I don't know how many people get to have such an experience. As I had to stand up, this guy was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and I had to stand up and read that guilty verdict, and I had sat where that man was sitting before. What a deal. What a deal. And I began loving life. I've only been arrested once since I've been sober. And I did time for the March of Dimes. I got arrested by the March of Dimes for being a prominent citizen in my community. What a deal. I went back to school and started working those minimum wage jobs. I learned about punching a time clock. I learned about being responsible. I learned about going to my AA meeting after my first paycheck. And when they passed the basket, I put my dollar in that basket. I got a standing ovation from my home group. learned to become a giver, learned to become a helper instead of always being a taker. And God allowed that in my life. The 12 steps allowed me to put God in the center of my life and be directed by Him. And I do the best I can on a daily basis. And I strengthen that relationship with my higher power. You know, God, you got to remember, God is so old. Sometimes He's slow about getting around to you. He's not as instantly as I want Him to. But God, you know, I can wait. I've learned that the answer always isn't black or white, you know? And I just am so grateful I didn't get what I deserve. Life took on a new meaning, and I began to enjoy life. I mean, I was having such an awesome time with you people, and God, I just, you know, I was whole. I went to school, got some initials behind my name, which has led me into doing what I do today, and I'm so grateful. You can teach old dogs new tricks, you know? It's just been incredible. What a great journey and adventure. And then when I was 8 years sober in 1994, started getting tired and started having a few problems. And I went to the doctor, and he came back with the diagnosis of cancer. And he gave me 8 months to a year to live. And I couldn't believe it. I'm just now learning to love life and have a wonderful time, and it's going to be over. And I can remember so many times in my early sobriety, I would say, God, why me? Why me? And I could hear my sponsors would always say, why not you? And when I had cancer, this doctor tells me I've got cancer and I'm going to have to die, I walked outside and I looked up and I said, God, why me? And my sponsor's voice said, why not you? I'm no special. What guarantees do we have that just because we get in here and we get sober and we start doing God's will, that human things won't continue to happen to us? And then somebody put it in perspective for me. They said, Mickey, 95% of the people that have alcoholism die from it. Survival rate of cancer is much higher than that. You know? But I made a decision. I had to make a decision that if I was going to have to die, I was going to die a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is the highest honor I can achieve in this life. And so I stayed active, and I started doing the things. And then I came to Houston to MD Anderson Hospital, best cancer hospital in the world. Met this really young, cute doctor who ran these ungodly tests on me. That doctor has boldly gone where no man has gone before. Ran these ungodly tests on me and said, Mickey, you're not going to like what we're going to have to do, but I think I can save your life. And I didn't like what he was going to have to do. It was horrible. But I am willing to do anything to stay here with you one more day. I'm not afraid of dying. I have a wonderful relationship with God. I think dying's like going home, you know? But I don't want to. I want to be here with you. The human experience is so incredible to me. I don't want to miss anything. I want to be here with you. So I told this doctor, let's go for it. And I had the second worst surgery. I don't know what the first worst is. I don't want to know. If you know, please don't tell me. I had the second worst, and that was bad enough. But I ended up going through radiation and chemotherapy, and then I went through this horrible, awful surgery, and with some more chemo after that. And I did a lot of other things, too. People would come to me, and they'd say, Mickey, I heard if you do this, this will help you. So I went to Indian sweat lodges. I did hands-on healing. I did Reiki. I burn sage in my house. I have feathers. I have crystals. I have angels. I have talismans. I went to churches where people fell out, talked in tongues, had snakes. You name it, I did it. If you came by and said, I think this will help you, I was there. Because I don't believe it's so important whether I believed it would help me or not, but you did, and there's power in whatever it is that you believe. Real power in what you believe. Please pay attention to what you're believing, because there's power in it. And so what I can tell you this today, the last time I had some examination, the cancer was gone. Now, I don't believe that it's because I'm a special person. I don't believe it's because God chose me. Far better people than me die every day of cancer, of alcoholism, of other things. I just think it's good luck, good fortune, good medicine, good stuff, you know. Nor do I believe. At one point in time, some guy came to me and he said, Mickey, are you angry at God? You got this cancer. Are you mad at God? And I thought, man, why would I be mad at God? You see, I don't believe anymore in that little petty God that's sitting on some throne somewhere that says, you know, Mickey looks like she's doing okay. Let's flick a little cancer on her and see how she handles that. If I believed any part of that, then God is my problem. And God is not my problem today. God is my solution. I went to my doctor one day and I said, I know I have this cancer, and he said, no, you don't. And by the way, I had colorectal cancer. What a this really, really cute doctor, why couldn't this be a wart on my finger, you know? But I ended up with colorectal cancer, and I went to him today and promptly tried to tell him why I had this colorectal cancer, and he said, we really don't know, it's probably genetic. I said, no, I'm telling you, I know why I have it. And he said, why? And I said, from so many years of men blowing smoke up my ass. Made perfect sense to me. I still have to go to all those regular checkups, and I'm just so grateful. I'm just so grateful today to be able to be alive and to have the experiences that I have in life. And, you know, none of us are exempt from having bad things happen in our life. Life is going to continue to be life. I don't think it's so much what happens to us as our attitude towards it, and that we're right with ourselves and we're right with the people around us and we're right with God. And, you know, it was during that period of time when I really became involved with the people in Lambda. I don't know what I would have done without this young lady right here when I was sick. Connie took such good care of me. It was amazing when I was doing all that radiation and chemo and I ended up losing all my hair. Those lesbians just came out all over the place. And they just grabbed a hold of me and they just loved me and loved me and loved me and loved me. I mean, I found out I looked really, really cute bald. They thought I was really cute bald. Having to beat them off and all that kind of stuff. But there was this little Lambda group that came and they just kind of took it upon themselves to take care of me. And Connie went hundreds of times with me to the doctor to get my treatment. They held me when I needed to be held. They made me laugh when I needed to laugh. They let me cry when I needed to cry. They cleaned my house. They mowed my yard. They bathed my animals. You know, when I came home and I was so sick and had these smaller children that needed to be taken care of, there was always food at my house when I got home. And I will never be able to thank you for all that you did for me. She was there when I went crazy in the hospital. I just can never thank you enough for being the good friend that you've been to me. I think sometimes that the reason I was the one that got sick is because I couldn't have been as good to a friend to somebody who was sick as people were to me. Because they just loved me, loved me, loved me. All my life I had been a taker, and Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to learn to give. And the year I was sick, it taught me to receive. And that was tough. It was hard letting people love you and take care of you. But I will always be so grateful. It was the worst, best year of my life. You know? They had a Mickey B day. And they had this auction and raffle and dance and all this kind of stuff. And it was for Mickey B day. And they raised up enough money in one day that when I left MD Anderson Hospital, I didn't owe them a dime. How do you give back to that? How do you make him? How do you say thank you for that? You know, it just seems so shallow. The only way I know how is to keep doing what it is that I'm doing, you know, and just trying to love people no matter who they are and trying to help them change the things about them that they want to change. And I'm just so proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love each and every one of you. Thank you again so much for having me, and I'll close in saying, I'm probably not what I should be, and I'm probably not what I could be, but thank God I'm not what I used to be. Thank you for having me.